The program you are about to hear was taped on Sunday afternoon, February 1, 1987, before a packed house of 1,500 people at Beverly Hills High School Auditorium. The speaker is Mr. Daniel Sheehan, General Counsel of the Christic Institute, Washington, D.C. Mr. Sheehan's subject is Iran, the Contras, and the international drug trade.
I am James Burford, Vice President of the Southern California Chapter of Americans for Democratic Action and co-chair of Forum West.
The co-chair of Forum West is our beloved Rabbi Leonard I. Bierman. The founding rabbi of the Leo Beck Temple. I have a message from Rabbi Bierman, which says, "My dear friends, I regret that I cannot be with you today. I must be out of the city this afternoon, engaged in a joyful event, conducting a wedding. How important it is for us to be addressing the issues Mr. Sheehan's presentation. Without knowledge, the people perish, old biblical wisdom informs us. That truth must remain freshly remembered in these dark and confusing times. I send you every bright wish for Mr. Sheehan and for all of you. Some of you are new to us, so I'm going to tell you very briefly what Forum West is. Forum West is an independent, nonpartisan center for the prominent authoritative speakers to participate in debates, panel discussions, and meet the press type formats to probe the social and political issues of paramount relevance to the quality of our lives. Without commercial media restraints or formulas, free from the all-too-prevalent hype and the ideas reduced to pablum, Forum West will attempt to present a meaningful forum of ideas of significance. Forum West will make no endorsement of legislative issues or political candidates. The opinions expressed at the forum, our forum programs reflect those of the individual speakers. A series of discussions is being planned to take place throughout the year. We have with us this afternoon Mr. Daniel Sheehan. He is the General Counsel of the Christic Institute of Washington, D.C. A word about Daniel Sheehan. Daniel Sheehan, as I said, is General Counsel and Public Policy Director of the Christic Institute, which is a national interfaith public interest law and policy center. Mr. Sheehan spent more than 2 years investigating criminal activity in support of the Contras by the United States citizens. He is chief counsel for the La Penca lawsuit filed for the U.S. journalist Tony Avergon and Martha Honey. In October, he testified before a House committee investigating the private war being waged by Americans on behalf of the Contras. Mr. Sheehan was the coordinating counsel in the Greensboro civil rights suit, winning a federal jury decision in June of 1986 against 4 Ku Klux Klansmen, 2 Nazis, and 2 Greensboro policemen. As the principal attorney for Lynn Meck, the first sanctuary worker indicted, Sheehan's arguments prevailed on appeal. As lead counsel in the Karen Silkwood case, she and led the team of lawyers who won a settlement for the family of Karen Silkwood and a precedent-setting Supreme Court decision establishing the right of citizens to punish nuclear industry violators under the law. Dan Sheehan was one of the five attorneys for the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. And he was also involved in the Wounded Knee trials and the civil rights suit at Attica Prison in New York. Before helping found the Christic Institute in 1980, Mr. Sheehan's previously legal positions included litigation attorney in the law office of F. Lee Bailey, chief of litigation for the ACLU Rocky Mountain Regional Office, and general counsel of the United States Jesuit Headquarters Social Service Division. Sheehan attended Harvard College and graduated from Harvard Law School in 1970. A Rhodes Scholar nominee, he helped found the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. And now, my friends, it is my real thrill to be able to introduce to you this afternoon Mr. Daniel Sheehan.
Well, good afternoon. It's a real pleasure. After the years of fighting in the trenches against the Contra supporters here in the U.S., it's finally time for the American people to find out who they are, what they've been doing, and what it is that's going to result in their going to federal prison. Now, everyone here has heard about the scandal, the downing of a cargo plane on October 5th, and later in November, on November 25th, the startling revelations by Attorney General Edwin Meese about the secret sale of arms, spare parts for the F-14s and the TOW missiles to Iran, and the diversion of some of the profits from those sales to the Contras in Central America. We also know that as a result of those scandals, the legislative branch of our government has established two select committees, one in the United States Senate and one in the House of Representatives, to investigate the need for additional legislation and supervisory structures over the executive branch of our government. We also know that within the Executive Department, there has been appointed a special prosecutor, Mr. Walsh, to investigate potential criminal wrongdoing of those involved in this affair. What is less known is that there is an investigation and prosecution going on in the judicial branch of our government. Since May of 1986, there has been on file a federal racketeering charge in the judicial branch in the federal court in Miami. This is the case that you may have read about Friday morning, where the United States District Court in Miami has thrown out all of the motions of the defendants, the authorization to proceed with federal subpoena power to investigate the criminal racketeering activities of these people. Now, the questions that are floating in our nation today have been highlighted in a Senate Intelligence Committee preliminary report, which was released on Thursday, which left unanswered over one dozen major questions. Some of these are, did President Reagan know of the diversion of funds to the Contras from the Iranian sale of arms? Did President Reagan approve of the activities of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, dealing with the Contras, dealing with the Iranians, and dealing with the diversion of funds from the Iranian gun sale to the Contras? Who indeed are these shadowy arms merchants that we are beginning to hear about? Gubanifar, Hakim, Khashemi. Who are these people? And what role did the government of Israel play in the transfer of these arms to the Iranians? Who is this Theodore Shackley, who Khashoggi says is the man who first suggested the idea of trading arms for hostages in the Middle East. What role is it that this Mr. Buckley played in the exchange of arms, the man who was the CIA station chief in Beirut, who was one of the hostages? And more generally, in where in the world will this end? Now, these are a few of the questions that we know the special prosecutor is looking into and the select committees of our Congress are looking into. What we want to do today is to share with you the charges that have been placed against these people in the judicial branch of our government so that you can have a roadmap. You can't tell the players without the program. This indeed is the program of the oncoming criminal indictments, which we'll be hearing about over the course of the next year, which in our judgment will precede the impeachment of the President of the United States. What we want to do first is to review briefly the history of our common experience that sets a context for these extraordinary hearings and investigations. We all recall back in the days which seem to be in the dark, distant past, in January of 1979, when there was still then a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House of Representatives, and President Carter was in the White House, we remember that Tom Harkin from Iowa and a number of his colleagues succeeded in passing the Harkin Amendment, which prohibited the distribution of military hardware and military assistance to any government which systematically engaged in the violation of the human rights of their own citizens. Under that resolution of Congress, signed into law by President Carter, in early 1979, there was a resolution cutting off all military aid to the dictatorial government of Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua. This was taken up in accordance with the condemnation which spread across our world of that regime, resulting even in the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops, formally condemning that government, declaring that it had no legitimacy, and indeed came as close as we have ever seen to expressly authorizing the rising up of a people against their government on the grounds of justification. After the passage of these resolutions, cutting off all military aid to the Somoza government, a peculiar event began. Somehow, the flow of arms did not stop completely. What was discovered is that there was some secret source of funding and supply of arms to that dictatorship that was not stopped. After the Congress condemned it, after the President of the United States prohibited it, indeed, even after Stansfield Turner, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, had forbidden it. The flow of arms did not sustain. July of 1979, Anastasio Somoza was forced to flee his country and fled to the Bahamas. And very soon thereafter, we began to hear rumors of some group of former Somoza generals setting themselves up in Honduras in mounting a war against the new Sandinista government of Nicaragua. The Sandinista government of Nicaragua was recognized across the world, indeed even by the United States government, which had for so long supported the dictatorship of Anastasio Somoza. However, there were other things that were capturing the attention of the American public. There were the hostages that were being held in Iran. Indeed, the hostages that became the Achilles heel of the Carter administration, the weakness, the vacillation demonstrated by the administration in the face of this type of humiliation of our country, led to the rise and the challenge of Ronald Reagan. Many of us said to then, who would have ever believed that Ronald Reagan could have been considered a serious candidate for the presidency of this country? But because of the vacillation, the lack of resolve, the lack of effectiveness that was being demonstrated by the Carter administration in the face of that humiliation, indeed, Ronald Reagan rose to the occasion and became the Republican nominee for president and was elected. Now, we all recall that peculiar scene inauguration, on inauguration day, if we'll think back together, watching Ronald Reagan being sworn in and Carter going out, and at the same time, the bulletins flashing as the hostages in Iran were being released and being shipped out and put on planes and sent back. The strange relationship between the outgoing of one administration and the incoming of another in that terrible hostage crisis. But when the hostages had been returned and President Reagan had been sent to the White House, we began to hear immediately from the Reagan administration about this horrible Sandinista regime down in Central America, how they were a threat to our national security. The president came on and told us about how this rising communist government in Central America was only a couple days' drive from Harlingen, Texas. And each time he came on to talk to us about this, the distance decreased. Then became a day's drive. It was just a couple hours away. And indeed, when questions began to arise about this government down there, we began to hear about this so-called Contra Force, this force of former Somoza generals, the men who led to torturing and the mass slaughter of their own citizens, who were now being talked about by the President of the United States as moral equivalent of our founding fathers. We recall together, I believe, the early protestations of President Reagan that he had nothing to do with these Contras. He was in no way participating in supporting them, though he wished them well. And when the media and the American people failed to believe that and began to turn up evidence that, in fact, the Central Intelligence Agency had, since June of 1981, been providing military equipment and arms and explosives and training to these Contras, our president, who had been on television swearing to us that it wasn't true, then said, "Oh, you mean those Contras?" "Yes, by the way, we have been giving them support, but let me give you my word, once again, that the only reason that we're supplying them and the only extent to which we're supplying them is to interdict the flow of guns and arms from the terrible communist government in Nicaragua to the rebels in El Salvador." When the American people failed to believe that, and the American journalist community failed to believe that, President Reagan assigned the Central Intelligence Agency to do an evaluation. Indeed, a man by the name of David McMichaels from the CIA was assigned to do that investigation, and when he concluded that there was no evidence of any sort of any shipment of arms going from Nicaragua to El Salvador, he was terminated. And then the president gave us his word once again that, oh, yes, indeed, they had been doing more than just trying to interdict the arms. In fact, what he was trying to do was to apply pressure to the new Sandinista government to force them by military pressure from the Contras to live up to their promises made during the revolution against Somoza. All of those promises which you recall President Reagan supporting so much during his election, the hypocrisy of it was astonishing. So astonishing, indeed, that the American people didn't seem to remember that President Reagan had totally opposed the Sandinista. And now his protestations to try to make them live up to their promises rang hollow once again to the American public. Nothing demonstrated the falseness of his accusations so much as the revelation that the Central Intelligence Agency, in the end of 1983, had been caught mining the harbors of Nicaragua and indeed passing out manuals recommending that the Contras undertake political assassinations of the mayors, town clerks, and other functionaries within the civilian government of the Sandinista. That was too much for the American public, and they began to demand that all support for the Contras cease. That was the point at which President Reagan began to insist that it was essential to supplies in order to stop the establishment of a Soviet military base in Central America. Now, we then saw the growing of a full-scale war going on in Central America. You recall the extraordinary comments of our president saying that in the midst of the thousands of people being slaughtered, the massive civil wars going on in Central America, that unless our Congress gave $100 billion to these Contras, there was going to be major disruption in Central America. The extraordinariness of it all seemed to leave the American people numb. And then, in March of 1984, the United States Congress passed the Boland Amendment, explicitly forbidding the White House and any of the executive department agencies involved in intelligence activities from giving any aid whatsoever to the Contras, either direct or indirect. This is where we were in March of 1984, with some 73% of the American people totally refusing to give any aid to the Contras, and then we heard about the beginning of the private groups that were coming to the fore, those led by Major General John K. Singlaub, the then president of the World Anti-Communist League, to undertake a major private operation against the Contras. And then we saw the President of the United States on television stating that I, too, am a Contra. This was the situation that we faced in March of 1984. I and the rest of us at the Christic Institute, with the rest of our fellow Americans, simply watched in amazement as the events surrounded us. But then, in March of 1984, we had a phone call that began the long road that has led us here today. We were contacted at the Christic Institute by the Catholic Bishop of Brownsville, Texas, indeed the Harlingen District of Texas, which in fact had been the base for the first stop on the Underground Railroad in the Sanctuary Movement. The Bishop of Southern Texas in Brownsville, John Fitzpatrick, contacted us and told us that, in fact, some of the people at Casa Romero, the sanctuary home that he had established within his diocese, these people had been arrested by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And the unfortunate fact was that they had been bringing two Central American refugees out of the Harlingen District in the bishop's car. This immediately attracted the interest of the bishop, and indeed the interest of the United States Attorney in Brownsville, who brought criminal indictments against Catholic sister Diane Mullenkamp, who was driving the car, the two refugees, a translator, a woman by the name of Stacy Lynn Merck, who had been riding in the car, translating for the refugees to a young reporter from the Dallas Times-Herald, Jack Fisher. All of the people have been arrested and charged with unlawful transportation of undocumented aliens. The Christic Institute was asked by the church to come to Texas to undertake the first of the criminal defenses of the people from the sanctuary movement. When we arrived, myself and my chief investigator on that case, a Catholic priest, a man named Father Wally Kozabowski, who had served in Nicaragua when the Sandinista were still struggling there, we went down and we began to prepare for the preliminary hearing in that case. And we were contacted by a Methodist minister who came to us in a very high state of anxiety and said to us that he had been working to discuss in his church the possible establishment of a sanctuary when he was approached by a field agent for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And that FBI agent had told this minister that he and his parishioners should have nothing to do with the Catholic Church or the sanctuary movement, stating that he was in possession of information that the Catholic Church and the sanctuary movement was, under the guise of the sanctuary movement, smuggling known communist terrorists into the United States, and that these known communist terrorists, in the event that our president was forced to undertake direct military action in Central America, either in El Salvador or Nicaragua, that these known communist terrorists were going to be organizing themselves into military cadres and launching military strikes against U.S. military bases, communication centers, and water resource systems. Now, this caused some distress to the Methodist minister, and after some consultation with the bishop's staff in the Harlingen District, he came to me, and he said, "Look, I understand that you served as general counsel for the United States Jesuit Headquarters, Social Ministry Office in Washington, and I know that I can trust you, and you will tell me if there's anything like this going on." Well, after Father Kozabowski and I picked ourselves up off the floor in hysterics, I had to become a bit serious, and I said to the minister, "Listen, Reverend, if that were going on, at least the Jesuits would know about it." And as their lawyer in the Social Ministry Office, I would have been informed, and I had not been. and I was positive that it was not true. And I gave him our assurances that he could return to the discussions at his church without the anxiety with which he had come to us. Well, that was a kind of a humorous situation until approximately a week later, Father Kozlowski and I were contacted by yet a second minister who in another church had been discussing the possibility of sanctuary and had been approached by yet a, and had been told exactly the same thing. Well, now that was much more serious. Now, the reason that we had to investigate to find out where the source was of those types of stories was because if, in fact, the Justice Department against whom we were defending in that case really believed those types of stories, we were obviously going to be confronted with a much higher degree of militancy than we had any justifiable right to expect. And so, after the preliminary hearing, we returned to Washington, D.C., and I established contact with some investigative reporters and some former federal agents who are now private investigators that I had encountered in a number of my former incarnations as an attorney for the New York Times and NBC and as an attorney in the office of F. Lee Bailey, that I had come to know a number of these people and knew they had very good sources, and I asked them to investigate for us as a favor to us if they would. They did, and I learned in the second week of April of 1984 that President Ronald Reagan, on the 6th of April of 1984, had signed a highly classified national security decision directive directing the initiation of a highly secret readiness exercise in the United States. That this was a readiness exercise which was to be undertaken domestically to determine what types of steps had to be taken by various federal agencies here stateside in the event that the president take military action in Central America. The readiness exercise was going to be codenamed Rex 84. The operation in Central America, the direct military operation in conjunction with which this readiness exercise was to be undertaken, was to be codenamed Operation Night Train. As we began to investigate this, we discovered that the whole readiness exercise was going to be undertaken and supervised by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Now, that came as somewhat of a surprise to us, since the Federal Emergency Management Agency was supposed to be involved in hurricane relief, flood relief, and civil defense. These are those geniuses who brought you the post-nuclear war scenarios of how they would reestablish the phone system after an all-out nuclear attack on the United States, how they would move the entire population of Los Angeles out to, I think, one of the small towns, I think out here in the mountains, in a couple days, they figured it would take them. That's a Hatchepi. That's right. But this was the group that was supervising this readiness exercise. That did not instill a great deal of confidence in us that readiness exercise was a serious operation. However, our further investigations revealed to us that the Reagan administration had brought to Washington to run the Federal Emergency Management Agency a man, Louis Jafreda, had been the commandant of the California Organized Crime Training Institute, which had specialized in anti-terrorist training for police departments. And the commandant, as he liked to be called, had been made the general of the National Guard of California under then Special Assistant Attorney General Edwin Meese. And they had undertaken here in your state a special secret program, which was codenamed Operation Cable Splicer. And that secret program was a program pursuant to which then Governor Ronald Reagan, his assistant attorney general, and the commandant, the general of the National Guard in California, would undertake to establish a state of martial law in your state in the event that the black nationalists joined forces with the anti-Vietnam War community and tried to replace the established authority of the state of California. Now, I pursued the investigation, seeing that this was a strange person who was heading up this operation, and came to learn through a source that we developed inside the Federal Emergency Management Agency that there was a plan whereby the Federal Emergency Management Agency would deputize members of the Defense Department and then the state National Guard groups. And they would organize civilian groups called State Defense Forces. and that their job under readiness exercise, the Rex 84, was going to be to, in the event of direct military action in Central America by the president, FEMA was going to round up 400,000 undocumented Central American aliens and place them in 10 military detention camps throughout the United States within a 2-week period. Now, any similarity that this program might recall to you to the Japanese roundup after Pearl Harbor is not coincidental. The fact that everyone has continued to be appalled by that in our generation, and yet the administration still dared to go forward with this, is explained only by the legal brilliance of Ed Meese. For you see, Ed Meese had made a distinction here, saying that, well, these 400,000 people aren't even Americans. And therefore, since they're not even supposed to be here anyhow, it'll be perfectly legal for us to do that, since they will be threats to the national security during a direct military operation. Well, given the fact that we were working with the sanctuary movement at the time, you can imagine the degree of distress that this caused. I communicated this information to the leadership of the sanctuary movement, and then, continuing the investigation, discovered that there was a second part to Rex 84. This designated a vote. This particular part of the operation had to do with moving large amounts of military equipment from the Defense Department to the State National Guard units down to these state defense forces. And we learned that these state defense forces had recently been created by means of the passage of these very little-known statutes in three states, Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas. And that in these states, the only people who had heard about these state statutes setting up these state defense forces were the men who participated in the weekend war games at the survivalist training camps and in the soldier of fortune groups. These were the men that were signing up to participate as members of these state defense forces. And when contacted in Louisiana, we discovered that there was a source that we developed who was talking with a colonel in the National Guard who said, yes, there was going to be this great readiness exercise coming up, and this military equipment was coming down to the National Guard to go to these state defense forces. But very interestingly, when these millions of dollars of equipment were distributed during the readiness exercise, say hypothetically $25 million, at manufacturer cost value of the military equipment, when the equipment was out in the field in the hands of these people, it was going to be reevaluated on the books for replacement value. We'd rather back $25 million worth of military equipment. And since it costs approximately twice as much to replace the equipment as it did to manufacture it, it meant that approximately 50% of all of the military equipment was going to be secretly left in the field. And then we discovered that it was to be smuggled to the Contras in Central America. So by pure happenstance, we who had been working with the churches and synagogue groups in the sanctuary movement had stumbled across a program whereby the administration was trying to smuggle embezzled military equipment to the Contras here in April and May of 1984. When we learned this, I reestablished contact with a number of our investigators and journalists to ascertain if they had learned of anything similar to this. And at that point, I was contacted by a journalist, an old friend of mine, who in fact brought the next piece of startling information to me. He brought to me the fact that he had gone down to Florida over the holiday season of Christmas holidays and the holiday season of 1983 and had discovered a Contra military training base inside the United States, down below Florida, down below Miami. And he had gone there to interview these people in late 1983 and had come to know that there was an American group organizing to provide military assistance and financial assistance to the Contras. They indeed were going to be holding a meeting down in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, in January of 1984. And so this young reporter, being the enterprising soul that he was, went back to his newspaper and asked if he would be allowed to go and report that. And he was told no, that he could not go. Well, then he recommended that some other reporters, more experienced than he, go. And they said no. So he took a leave of absence from his paper and on his own nickel went down to Honduras and went to the hotel and went to the lobby of the hotel and bought a newspaper and put the newspaper up in front of him and sat around in the lobby and watched all of these guys coming and going in their Gucci camouflage suits and their trading their patches, comparing the length of their guns. They were engaged in this rather extraordinary convocation. And he simply sat there and watched all of these people. And finally, he started talking to a man who was sitting next to him and saying that, look, I'm a writer. I'm really interested in what's going on down here. And this man said, hey, well, look, I know all these guys. Why don't I show you around? Why don't I introduce you to all these people? And he did. He basically took this young fellow under his arm and brought him around and introduced him to everyone. This man was Tom Posey, the founder of the civilian in the United States. And lo and behold, this young journalist was ushered into the inner sanctums of the Civilian Military Assistance Group. Indeed, sat in on executive committee meetings of CMA and hadn't known what in the world he was supposed to do about what he was finding out about. Because he was learning about the National Guard in Alabama, the 20th Special Forces, declaring all kinds of arms surplus and giving them to the Civilian Military Assistance Group, who were then bringing them to Florida and flying them out to Ilopango Air Base. And then when I began to discuss this with him, we discovered that the military equipment in Louisiana was supposed to be brought to a particular warehouse and flown out to Ilopango Air Base, where it was all going to be brought with this stuff from Alabama down to the farm of a millionaire rancher down in Costa Rica, a man by the name of John Hull, who had become the major ally for the Contras down in Costa Rica. Well, we were quite distressed by this and felt that we should hurry up and find ourselves a client, since we are an organization that is tax-exempt in a public interest organization like the American Civil Liberties Union or the NAACP. We're allowed to engage in fomenting litigation. So we began that quest there in the beginning of June of 1984. At that point, I had to go down to Texas to do the sanctuary trial. We went down, we did the trial, we won the thing on appeal, had all the charges dismissed against the sanctuary workers, and provided what we hope was an important base of law. And at the conclusion of that trial, I returned to Washington and was contacted immediately by this young journalist. And he said, Dan, you've got to come meet me. Something very important has happened. I went and met him, along with another one of my investigators, Father William J. Davis. And we went and had a meeting out in a public park where he wanted to meet. And he said, look, while you were gone, Tom Posey came to Washington. He met me and brought me to a public park and introduced me to a man by the name of Rob Owen. This man, Rob Owen, began to explain to me that he was going to be the private liaison from the National Security Council, working for a man by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. And that Rob Owen was going to be the man that met with the Contra leaders and took their weapons orders, made sure they got their weapons, and maintained liaison with the White House, in direct defiance of the congressional ban against White House support for the Contras. This young journalist wanted to know and have my advice as a lawyer whether that was as illegal as it appeared. I indeed explained to him at some length, this is now at the end of June, sitting in his living room, explaining to him that what we had here was a full-scale criminal conspiracy going on inside the White House to violate the United States Neutrality Act, to violate the United States Arms Export Control Act, to violate various banking laws for the transfer of these monies, and that in fact what we were looking at is the impeachment of any U.S. government official that was participating in that program. At that point, the young journalist brought his information to his board of editors, who looked at the information and told him that he would not be allowed to write any stories on that unless he could talk to someone who was directly involved and who made their statements under oath. Now, that's not something that a journalist usually encounters. You don't usually go to a guy and say, hello, I've brought with my brought with me here a stenographic reporter and a notary public to sign you up under oath and let me interview you here. So he was quite distressed and thought that something had to be done. And given the resources that we had at the Christic Institute, the experience that we had had in doing the Karen Silkwood case and prosecuting the Klan and doing the Three Mile Island, we said, look, we're going to devote our resources and time and energy to making this happen. Let's work and find a client here. And at that time, in the beginning of July of 1984, I had to fly down and we did the depositions of the Ku Klux Klan and Nazi Party people down in Greensboro. And the police department, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division, went forward, prosecuted those people, won $500,000 and kicked them around and won that. And then we finished that case. So I was out of town for some months at that point. And when I came back to town, we then began to have more meetings, and we learned that while we'd been engaged in these cases, an extraordinary event had taken place down in Nicaragua. What had happened is Eden Pastora, who was the famous Comandante Zero, the Sandinista hero who had led major military operations against the dictator Somoza, had become disenchanted with the Sandinista government. The Sandinista government, in response to the attacks and harassment by the Contras, had begun to take less and less popular positions on things, had shut down some of the media, had taken steps that made it very difficult for them to provide supplies to people in the stores, that it was becoming more and more difficult for them. And Comandante Zero, Eden Pastora, had become disenchanted and had decided that he was going to leave Nicaragua, indeed was going to go south into Costa Rica, and was going to set up a group, an independent Contra group, not a Contra group working with the Somoza generals up in Honduras and working with the CIA that had been working under Bill Casey, but was going to set up an independent Contra force. But what had happened during the times we were doing the Sanctuary trial and the Greensboro trial had happened was that there had been major pressure applied to this group, ARDE, down in Costa Rica, and to Eden Pastora, to force them to come under the command of the Honduran military generals, or the actual military generals in Honduras, that were the old Somoza generals. And in May of 1984, Eden Pastora had called a public press conference, and he was going to denounce the FDN, the major Contra movement, and the United States Central Intelligence Agency for attempting to co-opt and subvert his nationalistic Contra group. At that press conference held in the jungle camp of Eden Pastora on May 30th, Memorial Day of 1984, you can see the videotapes to this day as they came up the river into the jungle camp and the numerous journalists climbed out. You see among them a Danish journalist with a large aluminum camera case with a baseball cap on, walking with them, chatting merrily, into the building where the press conference was to be held. You see this man, Per Anker Hansen, move to the front of the room on the videotape and place his large aluminum camera case next to the table where Eden Pastora would hold his press conference. When Eden Pastora comes into the room and all of the journalists begin to surge to the front of the base camp room and the beginning of the press conference starts, you see a young woman, Maria, bring a cup of coffee to Comandante Zero and accidentally kick over the camera case, which falls on its side, and no one pays much attention. She gives him the coffee, and the press conference commences. What you then see is this alleged Danish journalist begin to skulk out of the room, moving across the side of the room on the videotape and out the door. And immediately thereafter, a deafening roar engulfs the building, destroying everyone in sight, killing 8 people immediately, killing 3 international journalists, including an American journalist, Linda Frazier, blowing off the arms and legs, blinding, tearing off the limbs of the journalists assembled. Indeed, 24 people were massively injured, and indeed, everyone would have been slaughtered by the bomb had it not been for the fortuitous event of it having been turned onto its side. It came out of deadly C4 explosives, the types of explosives that are second only to nuclear devices in their explosive capacity, a thing which is very difficult to obtain unless you have intelligence contacts with the Central Intelligence Agency and other intelligence groups. In fact, what had happened because it had been turned on its side is that it blew the entire roof off the building and blew the entire floor out instead of laying waste to everyone laterally. Now, when the bulletins went out across Costa Rica that this had happened, one of the people listening at home on the radio was a young reporter by the name of Martha Honey. She was a young American reporter, but she reported for the Canadian Broadcast Corporation and reported for the London Sunday Times. Her husband had been at this press conference, Tony Avergon. Tony Avergon was the ABC television cameraman who had been assigned to go to the press conference to film the press conference. He had been devastated by the bomb, had torn out a portion of his side, had burnt the whole arms of his hand, had shrapneled him in the face and chest, and he was in critical condition and flown out by helicopter from the hospital later to the U.S., where he underwent months of plastic surgery. Martha Honey, being the person that she is, insisted upon going to the United States Newspaper Guild and asked for a grant to look into who it was, a horrendous bombing, to work with her fellow journalists to bring to justice these people. She began her investigation and had an extraordinary event occur. In early 1985, during her investigation, a young man by the name of Carlos Rojas Chinchilla, a young carpenter down in Costa Rica, was sitting at a restaurant and bar a couple blocks from the United States Embassy when in came three men. And one of them was left at the door and the other two left. And that man that was left at the door looked around and came over to Carlos and sat down and told him that he wanted him to help him, that he had to escape, that he was a participant in the terrorist bombing at La Penca that murdered the people at the press conference, and that he was part of a terrorist band, an international band of Contras, who were now planning to blow up the United States Embassy, who were going to assassinate the United States Ambassador to Costa Rica, Louis Tams, who were based on the ranch of a millionaire American rancher by the name of John Hull, that these had been the people indeed that had carried out the assassination of the journalists and were planning to kill the United States Ambassador to instigate a major event to cause a provocation for the U.S. to blame the bombing of their embassy on the Sandinista government and to launch a military strike against that government. This man shared the information with Carlos, and Carlos, to his utter amazement, later learned that some people had been arrested, a few people off Hull's ranch, who fit the exact description of these people. And when he realized that this was true, he went to the only North American family that he knew to have them go warn the embassy. And the daughter of that family happened to know Martha Honey and went to Martha, shared the information. They went to talk to this man, David, and they began a series of interviews through Carlos in the public parks, on tape recorders, in churches, in hotel basements, all across the city, gathering the information about this terrorist group. Until one day, Carlos and David were caught by John Hull's terrorists in a park, and thrown in the back of a car and held at gunpoint and brought to the ranch where they were held in a wooden shed. And David told them that they were going to be killed if they didn't get out of there. And so the two of them, taking their lives in their hands, leaped on this guard and knocked him down and jumped, broke through a window, and ran into the jungle in a fusillade of bullets and escaped through the jungles and eventually made their way back to civilization where they were picked up. And they began to share their story with the Costa Rican authorities, with the intelligence, with the people there. However, the Monge government that was in power at that time was sympathetic to the Contras, and so therefore the journalists themselves had to continue the investigation. And weeks later they learned that David, who had run off to a separate place, had been brought to Hull's ranch and tortured to death and buried on John Hull's ranch. And at that point, they had to take Carlos out of the country and to assist him in escaping. And then death threats began to come daily to the home telephone of Martha and Tony Avergon, telling them that they had to stop this investigation, that they would be killed, that their children would be killed if they did not leave. They then contacted their journalist acquaintances and asked for help across the nation. And they contacted us at the Christic Institute and asked us to help. And that is what we do at the Christic Institute. It's why we come to people such as you to ask your help to get this information out across the country. And when we began to investigate, we began to confirm this story of this terrorist group. And, of course, we had the additional information about the movement of guns and explosives and hardware from the U.S. down to this ranch. And at that point, they prepared, Martha and Tony prepared a report, which they published in Costa Rica, and John Hall sued them for libel down in Costa Rica, which in Costa Rica is a felony criminal charge of which you are presumed guilty unless you can prove that you're innocent. The Christic Institute went in and undertook the defense of Martha and Tony, helped them organize witnesses and bring them to the bar of justice, and brought them on to testify and defeated John Hall. In very, very prophetically, John Hall, in a major frump at the end of the trial, stomped out of the courtroom and turned and said, "This isn't over yet." And little did he know how right he was. For we had resolved at that point to undertake a thorough investigation and prosecution of these people in the United States. What we learned from our investigation was that this terrorist band on John Hull's ranch, in addition to bringing in all the military equipment and training and dispensing the terrorists into Nicaragua, had in fact been funding their operation by the smuggling of hundreds of tons of cocaine in from Colombia, because they had virtual carte blanche to bring this military equipment from the U.S. down to the ranch through Ilopango. In fact, the U.S. government officials in the Reagan administration were turning a blind eye and a deaf ear to those shipments. And so they would move the planes down with the military equipment down through Ilopango into the Costa Rican ranch, load up with 600-pound loads of cocaine, and fly back into the United States, coming right back up the same channels that they had cleared through the radar to allow them to bring these guns to those who were the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. And as we began to research the statutes that were available, we discovered, much to our amazement, that there was this federal racket. There was, in fact, a federal criminal statute, the same one that they just prosecuted the 8 mob leaders in New York for. And at the very bottom of this statute, it said, by the way, if you run a business and your business has been injured by the activities of such a criminal enterprise, you can sue that criminal enterprise and recover 3 times your actual damages. And we began to interview people and discover that Tony Avergon was, in fact, a private businessman. In fact, was a freelance cameraman who was hired by ABC to go and do the Lapenka press conference. And the bombing had destroyed all of his television equipment. His business had been injured. And being the defenders of free enterprise that we are, we determined that we were going to vindicate the business community of America and close down this criminal enterprise. Now, all of this was preliminary to finding out the really important information in this case. Because once we had gotten hold of this federal criminal statute, we learned that when you undertake to prosecute a particular overt act of a criminal enterprise under the Racketeer-Influenced Corrupt Organization Act, you can also sue all of the members who are participants in the more general criminal enterprise, of which that is just one overt act. And so we then turned our attention to the criminal enterprise itself, which, of course, was the federal criminal conspiracy to violate the United States Neutrality Act to mount a criminal war against the government of Nicaragua. And when we began to investigate who was participating in that enterprise, we had another fortuitous visit from a former military intelligence agent who came to us and he said, "Don't you realize who the people are that you're dealing with here?" Well, we didn't know whether to pretend to be very knowledgeable and therefore stupid, or to say like we always do, "No, we don't know much more than the American people know. What's the facts?" And he said, "I will tell you who they are, and when you undertake your investigation, you will discover what they are. The people you want," he said, "are Theodore Shackley, Thomas Clines, Richard Secord, Albert Hakim, Raphael, name of Eric von Marbod." "Okay," we said. And we went out to find out who these people were. In the extraordinary series of events that began to unfold, which resulted in the ruling that you heard about this past Friday, where the federal court in Miami said that what you have here is an ongoing criminal enterprise which has gone on since 1960. Because what we discovered is that the man who was directing the operations, supplying the guns and military hardware into the Contras in Central America, was indeed a man by the name of Theodore Shackley. Theodore Shackley had been the worldwide director of covert operations for the United States Central Intelligence Agency in 1976 under George Bush, when he was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And as we began our investigation of Mr. Shackley, we discovered that he indeed had been the man in 1961 who had run the major Contra operation against the Cuban Socialist Revolutionary Government, starting in 1961. That the United States CIA had run a about which the American public knew virtually nothing, both before and after the Bay of Pigs. And I will now tell you what it is that we all need to know. What we discovered was that back in late 1959, when Fidel Castro drove the dictator Batista from Cuba, he also drove out the organized crime syndicate from Cuba. The major criminal operation that was operating under the name of Resorts International. It was Meyer Lansky's major criminal syndicate that ran the casinos and hotels and prostitution rings in Havana. They indeed were business partners with Batista, and they were all driven from Cuba in Havana in 1959. They came to southern Florida, and there they were contacted by then Vice President Richard Nixon in the Nixon-Eisenhower administration. Indeed, Richard Nixon was the point man who was responsible for establishing inside the National Security Council a secret committee that was responsible for mounting basically a Contra war against Cuba, that they had determined that they did not like the politics or the economics of the Cuban government, and therefore they were going to secretly recruit the ultra-right-wing supporters of the dictator Batista and train them at a military base in southern Florida, in the Keys, a military training base in Guatemala. And there they would train these people to constitute a Contra guerrilla force, and that they would undertake attacks into Cuba, riding on swift boats. They would blow up bridges, burn crops, poison export materials from Cuba to destroy their economic infrastructure. And that this operation began in late 1959, and it was codenamed Operation 40. But not satisfied with that, then Vice President Richard Nixon received communications from a man by the name of Santo Trafficante. Santo Trafficante had been the lieutenant for Meyer Lansky, running the Havana operations for the New York mob. And he had come to Florida and had learned about this secret Operation 40, since a large portion of the people that had been recruited by the CIA to work in that had been the criminal elements working for Batista and Santo Trafficante in Havana. And learning about that, he wanted to help. Being the red-blooded patriot that he was, and, of course, the beneficiary of a multi-million dollar criminal enterprise that had been driven from Havana. And they wanted to reestablish that in Havana. And he reached out through two men. One was a man by the name of John Roselli. Another man was a man by the name of Sam Giacana, the Don of the Mafia in Chicago. These two men were designated by Santo Trafficante to meet with a representative of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon selected a man with whom he was having an extraordinarily secret contact, the man who was the head of the empire of Howard Hughes, a man by the name of Robert Mayhew. Because of the secrecy of their ongoing relationships, he was selected to undertake this super secret communication. This meeting took place at the Fontainebleau Hotel in early 1960. And there, Richard Nixon, through his representatives, and Santo Trafficante, through his representatives, agreed to set up a suborganization inside Operation 40, which was a professional assassination unit. And this unit was given the responsibility for carrying out the political assassination of Fidel Castro, his brother Raul Castro, Che Guevara, and five other men in the leadership of the Cuban government. This group was recruited out of the Operation 40 people, known to Richard Nixon and a limited number of people alone, and was trained in a secret triangular fire base down in Mexico. This particular group had on it a number of very interesting people, people that you are coming to hear about every day that we live. One of the men on this secret team, this assassinations unit, was a man by the name of Felix Gomez. You know him as, he's Felix Rodriguez, and you know him as Max Gomez, as the man who directed the Ilopango airlifts into Nicaragua. Another man on this secret assassination team in early 1960, put together by Richard Nixon, was a man by the name of Ramon Medina, whose real name is Jose Posada Correa, who was the second man running the Ilopango airlift over into Nicaragua. Another man on this group was a man by the name of Rafael Chichi Quintero, the man who supervised the construction of the secret airstrip in Costa Rica that you've heard so much about of late. Indeed, the man who delivered the $2 million that was being given to bribe out Mr. Buckley from the Libyan, or the terrorists in Beirut, that was given by Mr. Ross Perot. Chichi Quintero and Tom Clines are the ones that delivered the money. The other people in this assassination team that you've probably heard about are a man by the name of Frank Sturgis, later caught in the Watergate Hotel in 1971 under then-President Richard Nixon. With him in the Watergate Hotel was a man by the name of Rolando Martinez, another man on the assassination team in 1960, run by Richard Nixon. Another man by the name of Diaz was on that assassination team, also found in the Watergate Hotel. Two more men, Raul Villaverde, on that shooter team. Running that team, one of the directors of that team, was a man by the name of E. Howard Hunt. This particular group had the extraordinary authority given to them by this secret group of National Security Council people headed up by the Vice President of the United States to carry out the slaughter, murder of the political leadership of the Cuban government. Now, that operation ran all the way to 1961 when President Kennedy came to office. All the indications are that he was never told about the assassination team. He was told about the Operation 40, the Contra operation against Cuba. And his young, industrious brother, Bob, decided that he would transmute Operation 40 into a full-scale invasion, which they tried in April of 1961 in the disastrous Bay of Pigs. They were all killed or captured. And by June of 1961, Bobby Kennedy had dropped back and reestablished the Operation 40 program, which they renamed Operation Mongoose. That particular program was put under the command and control of a young 34-year-old CIA official by the name of Theodore Shackley. His director of training was a man by the name of Tom Clines. They ran the Contra War, along with Ed Lansdale, against the Cuban government from 1961 to 1965. And then a very strange series of events. In 1965, this entire unit and team was transferred to Laos in Southeast Asia. Theodore Shackley became the deputy chief of station under Gordon Jurgensen. He brought with him Tom Kleins. They brought with them Rafael Chichi Quintero. They also brought with them Felix Rodriguez. They also brought with them Jose Posada Carrillo. Assassins, professional assassins, they brought with them. By 1966, Theodore Shackley and Tom Kleins were peculiarly supplying air power to a man by the name of Von Powell, a major opium trafficker in Laos, who was engaged in a three-way war with two other men for control of the opium trade in Laos. Tom Kleins supervised the air war, gave air power to Von Powell. They actually figured out a way of dropping bombs on these drug dealers for Von Powell. The man who ran the air operation for Von Powell under Tom Kleins was a young major in the Air Force by the name of Richard Secord. By the beginning of 1966, both of the opponents of Von Powell in this war for the opium market had been assassinated. And Von Powell was the undisputed controller of the opium trade in Laos. Very interestingly, he then, out of the largesse of his, decided that he would contribute an ongoing portion of the heroin income to finance the secret training of the Mayo tribesmen, the Hmong, down in southern Laos. They were being trained by the same man who was the commander of the Guatemalan base for the Cubans. And they were sent out to carry out the covert assassination of suspected communist sympathizers throughout Laos, Thailand, and Cambodia. By 1966, this program had been formalized into a group called the Special Operations Group, also known as the Joint Task Force on Unconventional Warfare, based in Vientiane. It was placed under the control of the military, even though it was in fact run by Theodore Shackley and Tom Kleins of the CIA. The man who was chosen as the military commander for that unit that supervised the Mayo tribesmen in the assassination program was Major General John K. Singlaub. The deputy air wing commander for the Special Operations Group became Richard Secord. In the end of December of 1968, a young Marine Corps recent graduate of the Naval Academy joined the Special Operation Group in Vientiane, a man by the name of Oliver North. One of the commanders of the Army Special Forces units in the Special Operations Group was a man by the name of Dewey Owen, the older brother of Rob Owen. This group functioned to supervise the political assassination of some 100,000 non-combatant civilians in Laos and Cambodia and Thailand, young mayors, bookkeepers, clerks, school teachers, to attempt to eliminate the infrastructure of that society for fear that it would fall into the hands of the communists. In 1968, Theodore Shackley became the chief of station in Laos, and a man by the name of Santo Trafficante from southern Florida flew to Southeast Asia and met in a hotel in Saigon with Von Powell. And by the end of 1968, Santo Trafficante had become the number one importer and trafficker in China white heroin in the United States. The China white heroin began to flow, and the commensurate profits began to flow to Von Powell. And the size of the Mayo tribesmen training group that was committing the assassinations began to burgeon accordingly. In 1969, Theodore Shackley was transferred to become the chief of station in Vietnam, and they established the now infamous Phoenix program that carried out the political assassination of some additional 60,000 non-combatant civilians, non-Viet Cong civilian operators in the country. He remained in that position until 1972, when Theodore Shackley and Tom Kleins were brought back to the United States for the agency. Now, since they don't do an awful lot in Canada, and they're doing less and less in the United States, that leaves you central in Latin America. Tom Kleins and Theodore Shackley ran the Track 2 operation against Salvador Allende in Chile and supervised the political capture and assassination of his chief of staff, General Snyder, and eventually the assassination of Allende himself. And when that had been accomplished in September of 1973, Theodore Shockley was transferred to become the head of Far East operations for the CIA. Now, at that point, we reach an extraordinarily important junction here, because Theodore Shockley and Tom Clines and his cohorts had come to the conclusion that the waffling American democracy was not going to continue their effort in Vietnam. And they were not going to continue their effort against the communists. And so they began an extraordinary program by means of which they took more and more money from Von Pau's heroin funds, had them transferred into Vietnam under the auspices of having to carry out a more and more massive Phoenix program, but in fact brought more money in there than was necessary and began to embezzle this money from Von Pau's heroin sales in this black program and transfer the money secretly to a bank in Australia, the Nugan Hand Bank. Millions of dollars were transferred between 73 and 75 in an extraordinarily sophisticated program. What they did is they had Tom Clines put millions of dollars into suitcases and get on an airplane and fly to Australia and unload the money and put it in the bank accounts. That went on from 73 to 75, and they also began to pilfer thousands of tons of U.S. military equipment from Vietnam and transfer it to a secret cache in Thailand. So that when the war ended in 1975, all of these people simply transferred. Where did they transfer to? Iran. Richard Secord was made the director of foreign military sales for the United States Pentagon in the Middle East. And where did Theodore Shockley go? Theodore Shockley was promoted from the director of Far East operations for the CIA to be the assistant deputy director for the CIA in charge of worldwide covert operations under George Bush. He, in fact, anticipated Theodore Shockley being named director of the CIA if, in fact, Ford had won the presidency and the Republicans had remained in office. Theodore Shockley almost certainly would have been made the director of the CIA. But when Carter won and Stansfield Turner became head of the Central Intelligence Agency, these people continued their operation of pilfering funds and sending them to this secret fund and established a unauthorized, secret, illegal assassination program in Iran and with the SAVAK. The man who was the director of their operations in Iran was a man by the name of Edwin P. Wilson. His assistant was Frank Turpel. These people carried out the assassination of many opponents of the Shah in Iran between 1976 and 1978. Now, that operation generated a peculiar resistance on the part of the Central Intelligence Agency that had not authorized it, was not supervising it, and they began to dismiss people from the CIA who were in covert operations. You recall that history with President Carter moving the people out of covert ops of CIA. They began to put pressure on Theodore Shockley to get him to stop some of his operations. But the fact is that they did not stop him, that what he did is he formed a private company in which he joined as partners with Edwin Wilson, Richard Secord, and Eric von Marbod. They formed a company originally known as the International Research and Trade Corporation, which later became EATSCO, the Egyptian-American Transport and Service Company. This company, through the good offices of Eric von Marbod, who had been the Assistant Secretary of Defense, filtered to that company all of the contracts to ship all of the weapons to Egypt in the Camp David Accords. And they began to make hundreds of millions of dollars in that company. And when it was discovered that Edwin P. Wilson was selling C4 explosives to Gaddafi, and Assistant United States Attorney Larry Barcella insisted upon indicting him, Larry Barcella began to investigate Shockley, Clines, Secord, von Marbod. But he was told to stop. And his indictments were insisted upon being restricted to simply Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel. And that was a terrible mistake, as it turns out, because what happened is Shockley was, while they were thinking of indicting him, it was a decision was made to just tell him to resign, he and Tom Clines from the CIA. Who was it that made that decision? The deputy director for operations of the CIA at the time, Frank Carlucci. Such that by the beginning of 1979, when the United States people, the United States Congress, the United States President, and the head of the Central Intelligence Agency had resolved in the beginning of 1979 to cut off all military supplies to Somoza, Ted Shackley and Tom Clines, at the end of February and early March of 1979, send Edwin Wilson to visit with Somoza. And they establish a contract where they're going to be selling military hardware to the dictator's policy. But after all, these men were now private citizens. They had not been indicted. They were running this company making billions of dollars. And they had access to all of the end-user certificates to get the military equipment. They had access to all of the contractors. And they continued to sell the equipment. And even when Somoza fled in July of 1979 and went to a place called North Cay in the Bahamas, Shackley and Klein sent their people to visit with him again and reestablish the contract, now to continue to sell them the military equipment in their new incarnation as the Contras. This indeed is the secret team that continued the flow of weapons. They continued the program of political assassinations. They would target the people who had to be assassinated, and they would send the information to a man who was then based in Army intelligence, a man by the name of Rafael Chichi Quintero, who at the same time was the man visiting with the Contras, taking their orders for military equipment and making sure that they were filled. And then Quintero would pass the information as to who should be assassinated onto Tom Clines and Theodore Shackley, who would then pass the information on to a man by the name of Buckley, who was the head of the Central Intelligence Agency's anti-terrorist program. This operation continued all the way up until Reagan became president. When Reagan became president in January of 1981, a series of interesting conversations began to take place in the White House, chaired by then Chief of Staff Ed Meese, along with Vice President Bush, President Reagan, Director of the CIA, Bill Casey, and the first National Security Advisor, Richard Allen. And by June of 1981, they had resolved that they would take over from the secret team the supplying of the military hardware and the weapons and the training. And they resolved in a June 1981 National Security Decision Directive that they would assign a man by the name of Victor M. Canestrero from the CIA to head up and take over the operation that had been run by Chichi Quintero. That operation ran, as we recalled at the beginning of our discussion, throughout these strange series of falsehoods about they didn't know the Contras, yeah, they were funding the Contras, and blah, 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 went all the way to the end of 1983, when in fact they were caught mining the harbors and passing out the assassination manual, and it became clear that in fact Congress was going to pass the Boland Amendment to prohibit their activities. So what did they do? They sent a young man who was now a lieutenant colonel in the National Security Council, Oliver North, to contact the secret team to say, why don't you do it some more? You did it from March of 79 until 81. Why don't you have the Contras and give them what they need, which they did. However, they needed a cover story. After all, everyone knew the agency had been supplying them for years now. If they continued to have the same amount, people might suspect the agency was doing it. So what they decided to do was to have a cover story, so they sent Oliver North to Gray & Company, a public relations firm of spooks in Washington, who a vice president of at that time, we understand, was a man by the name of John Tower. And they sought out a young man by the name of Rob Owen from that office, and he set up a thing called Idea Incorporated, and he began to provide the private inspiration around our country to help these poor Contras. And he was sent to get a man to head up that operation, a man by the name of General John K. Singlaub. And that operation raised probably $5 to $6 million total, most of which they spent on their little Learjets flying around the world. And yet it gave a cover to this massive influx of weapons to the Contras, all being run by the secret team. And so then when it was decided that the administration had to undertake this secret deal with the Iranians, they figured, who better than the secret team? After all, in for a penny, in for a pound. So these were the people that were sent, Secord, and the other man to Iran to deliver the cake and the Bible and the missiles. Why was it they became only terribly distressed in 1984 when Mr. Buckley was kidnapped? When Mr. Buckley was kidnapped and tortured, and they became intensely interested in getting him out. You recall we were told he was an independent businessman in Beirut. Then we were told that he was the station chief of the CIA in Beirut. What we were not told is that he had been the director of the anti-terrorist program for the CIA. And what was it that he knew that made this man so terribly dangerous in their hands? And why was it that we sent the Iranians 40 tractor trailer loads of TOW missiles after we knew he was already dead? What do you think it was he told them that was worth all that? And why was it that the Iranians sent a man by the name of Gubanifar to establish contact to see if they could get the weapons in exchange for something? Oliver North, Poindexter, Bud McFarlane? No. He went to Theodore Shackley. Gubanifar, in November of 1984, met with Theodore Shackley in Hamburg and decided that this was so serious, something had to be paid to these people. And who were the people? Were they moderates in the Iranian government? What will be discovered is that they were the very people who had tortured Mr. Buckley. These were the people to whom Mr. Buckley had been delivered from Beirut. He, in fact, was taken from Beirut to Tehran, was tortured to death in Tehran on videotape. What was it that he told them that made it worth paying all of that hush money? The fact of the matter is that because of this secret team that has been functioning in the bowels of our government for 25 years, the United States has not been humiliated, we have been blackmailed. And who is it that doesn't know what we have been doing? Do you think it's the Cubans? Is it the Nicaraguans? It is you, and it is me. It is the American people that these people fear. Because of the program of assassinations, the horrible, dark secrets that they know, of the source of their funding from the largest shipments of heroin into our country for the past 20 years, to the influx of over 1 ton of cocaine per week coming in through a shrimp company down in Miami owned by Francisco Paco Chanez that has been financing these black covert operations. So the questions that are floating are not indeed the right questions. Should we be asking ourselves the questions, do you think that Donald Reagan should resign? Do you think maybe Mr. Meese should quit? Do you think all of these lower guys will be cleaned up by Frank Carlucci? Do you think these were a group of subordinates acting without authority within the White House? Or is this, in fact, more like Watergate, where the congressional committees will go so far as to impeach Mr. Reagan, impeach Mr. Bush, impeach Mr. Meese, North, and Secord and Hakeem? Because let me say to you, if, in fact, that is all that happens, we will be dealing with a small cancerous nodule on the nose of the president. Whereas, in fact, what we are dealing with is a cancer deep in the chest of our body politic. And the intelligence community will tell us, along with the Republican Party, please, we can't operate. The body politic is not healthy and strong enough. Please, maybe we don't have cancer. Hope we don't have cancer. Maybe it will go away. You cannot do this. And the Democrats are suggesting that the people's confidence in our governmental structures will be too shaken if this information is made available to our public. The fact of the matter is, these are the people who have never had confidence in the structures of our constitutional government, have never obeyed the American people, have never had confidence in the United States Congress. These are the people who have been dealing in the back alleys and in the underworld for 25 years. Will we listen to those people when they say, please, our body politic is not strong enough to survive the operation? No, we won't. The fact is that this operation will be undertaken. Our body politic is healthy. Our body politic will rid itself of this cancer. And the people who will make that so are you and me, and the millions of people across our country who will not stand for this type of hypocrisy, who will not allow our country to take these types of positions by means of which we can be so clearly blackmailed. This will be put to a stop. It will be put to a stop now, and we will not be allowed to just face these minor questions. We will do this work. The Christic Institute has the federal case that has now been endorsed by the federal court system. We now have federal subpoena power. We know that this group is not, in fact, the moral equivalent of our founding fathers. They are indeed the moral equivalent of the mafia, and they will be treated as such. Thank you.